Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl and my guest today is Laura Forlano from New York. Hi.
Hi.
You are doing several stuff. You are within Wireless NYC and you're a researcher on information policy. But let's start with Wireless NYC. What is it about?
Sure. NYC Wireless is a community wireless organization based in New York. We've been active since 2000, when our founders Anthony Townsend, an urban planner, and Terry Schmidt, a computer technologist, found out that they could actually share wireless signals outside of their apartments and reach the parks in New York. So basically, they started experimenting with the technology, and Anthony, as an urban planner, he was very interested in public space and how public space could be changing with the wireless connectivity. So that's what started the project. And especially after 9/11 in 2001, he started working in downtown Manhattan to provide internet access to some of the small businesses that were without a connection after 9/11. From there, we actually worked in a lot of the major parks in New York. And one of the first big projects was the Bryant Park, which is behind the New York Public Library on 42nd Street and 5th Avenue. And the Bryant Park Restoration Corporation, which is a nonprofit that takes care of the park, was interested in providing wireless in the park. So our organization, NYC Wireless, provided the technical expertise about how to do that. And the project was sponsored by Intel. And for a very small startup cost of $10,000 of equipment costs, and about $1,000 in ongoing T1 DSL costs, they were able to provide wireless in the park. And today, Bryant Park is still one of the probably most heavily used outdoor wireless networks in the world because it's a very large Midtown Manhattan business district. And so in the summer months and even sometimes in the winter, you can see hundreds of people using the Bryant Park wireless network because it's a very nice space. There's a lot of available seating. There's trees, so you have a shade. So it's really become a very popular outdoor workspace. Since that time, NYC Wireless has networked with other community wireless groups around the world and started using a software that's open source in order to manage the network. And that software is called Wi-Fi Dog, and it was created by the Montreal wireless group Ile Sans Fil. And so we're continuing to be active in the public parks in New York. At the moment, we have about 13 networks that are up and running. Those networks we're constantly monitoring, and we're very active in providing support to the organizations that host the networks. Some of our earlier networks, we actually are not involved anymore in the ongoing operations. Like Bryant Park, we are no longer involved, but that was one of the early park projects that we did.
Okay, and you know a bit the Freifunk community in Germany.
Yes.
Is it similar or?
Yeah, Freifunk is a really exciting, I think, example. And what's so interesting in the community wireless networks around the world that I've visited, and over the last 5 years, I've visited the network in Djursland, Denmark, a community wireless network where the first Fresh Air Free Networks conference was held in 2004, in September 2004. And then there have been a number of conventions and summits here in the United States over the last 4 years, as well as in Europe. And so I've attended a number of those and also had the opportunity to visit the network in Budapest, as well as in Berlin, and networks here in the U.S. in Seattle and in Champaign-Urbana. And also in Montreal. So the one thing I've realized by visiting all these networks is that, well, on the one hand, these groups share a common vision about a really progressive type of information policy that revolves around local control of infrastructure, local control of content, and really local community engagement and participation. There's a common vision there that's global, but on the other hand, there's a very deep local contextualization. So every network is very different depending on which city or country you go to. There are different needs that are addressed. And so you see this a lot in the activities also in Berlin. So, for example, in New York, while the networks mainly revolved around public parks, in Montreal, they've mostly been active in cafes. In Budapest also, their networks are mainly in cafes. And in Berlin, the network is really different in that it's mostly on top of residential rooftops, from my understanding. And I've actually gotten on top of the roofs of some of those buildings in Friedrichshain and really seen the equipment and talked really deeply with some of the people who are active in that network. And also in Vienna, the network is more of a residential building rooftop network. So there are differences just in the network design and sort of the places where you can get wireless, but there are also differences in the people and kind of what their visions are. So here in New York, we're really focused on public spaces. And in other networks, they were focused on, for example, getting internet access in a neighborhood that was either on the, wasn't able to get connectivity. So in Berlin, in the eastern parts of Berlin, where they weren't able to have broadband access around the early 2000s.
Sometimes until now.
Yeah, and even today. And that's one thing that really motivates and inspires the activists that are working in community wireless projects, because when they have a breakdown or a failure or something where they have a problem that they need to solve, that's where they really start developing really innovative solutions. And so I just came from the International Summit for Community Wireless Networks in Washington, D.C., which is a regular event here in the United States, and it also attended by folks from all over the world. So we had representation by 20 countries, including India and Austria and Venezuela. And it was a really exciting summit. And Aaron Kaplan, the founder of Funkfeuer in Vienna, actually talked about the ways in which he started his network. And actually, it started because his laptop had fallen, and he had broke part of his laptop where the Ethernet cord was going in. And then he opened his laptop, and he found out that the laptop had a wireless card. I think this was back in 2003. And he said, okay, great, now I just have to build a wireless network all throughout Vienna so that I can use my laptop to access the internet. And amazingly enough, what they've done over the last few years is actually really build that network. So they currently have a 400-node mesh network running in Vienna. And he's really active on the point of integrating all the different open source softwares that different community wireless groups around the world have built. So, for example, the Champaign-Urbana Wireless Group here in the States has created some mesh networking protocols, and the Montreal Wireless Group, Ile Saint-Phile, has created Wi-Fi Dog, an open source splash page management and network management software, and FriFunk has created the OLSR protocols. And so by putting all of these together, now what they're able to provide, and this is just in the last few months, kind of working together, they've managed to integrate all these softwares and have a completely open hardware, open standard, and open source software for running community wireless networks. And they're also working on the interface so that non-technical people would be able to deploy that network. Because all of these networks, I think, at this point, are still relatively highly technical. And in order to, set up a node, you usually you have to have a lot of technical expertise. But as the years go on, we're seeing that it's becoming more and more easy to understand how to use the devices. And
Yeah, so that's the technical side a bit. On NYC Wireless, you are advocating free networks.
Mm-hmm.
What are reasons for cities, for example, to use these technologies?
Okay. Well, what we've seen really recently and over the last year, the municipal wireless network strategy has actually really failed on a large scale. In the last year, many of the large cities that first announced that they were going to start wireless networks, like Philadelphia and San Francisco and Chicago, these networks over the last few years have been pursuing a corporate model where Earthlink, the internet service provider, would come to the city with a plan of how the network would be built and designed and build that network. Unfortunately, because my belief is that because it's still very early and that we're still in a time when relatively early adopters are the Wi-Fi users. So, for example, according to the Pew Internet and American Life Project, only about 27% of people who have used the internet have used the wireless internet or used Wi-Fi outside of their home or office. So what this says is that we're still at a point where a very small percent of the population has experience using Wi-Fi. So it's difficult for businesses to find out how they can actually plan a sustainable business model with such a small user base. What we've seen in recent months is that Earthlink has actually, unfortunately, decided to get out of the municipal wireless business, and so they've tried to sell the networks that they had built in some cities, and they've also failed to reach an agreement with other cities. So with San Francisco, they were failing to reach an agreement, and with Philadelphia, they've just tried to sell the infrastructure that they had built. What this really means is that the municipal wireless model that has been being discussed over the last 4 years has really failed because it was really a very narrow vision of the ways in which these infrastructures could be implemented, and it was also a very top-down model. So what would happen is, you know, that Earthlink would build a network that really was not well connected with the social needs in the city. What community wireless networks offer, and really community wireless has been thriving over the last 4 years and really finding new applications and new advances. Community wireless networks, first of all, they're very bottom up, so they're not large scale yet, but there are ways to make them large scale. So they're very bottom up. They rely on individual volunteers and individuals actually to learn the expertise that's required. So that means that you have knowledge transfer in the community. If you could train some people in your community to learn how to, put up community wireless routers, for example, that there would actually be learning from the process, and that it's a very small scale, and it really depends on the participation of the community. So some of the real benefits of community wireless, at least the technological aspects, is that the technologies are open source, and they're much, much cheaper than some of the proprietary technologies that are being used. So, of course, there are many companies that have routers and antennas and all the different kinds of equipment, but those tend to be a lot more expensive, and community wireless can provide those for much cheaper. In addition to just the cost itself, these community wireless networks embody different kinds of political values. So they really rely on the participation of the community and using open source software. And really the future vision for community wireless is that if you know a little bit about a mesh network and what a mesh network is basically what's been really successful in, for example, Vienna with 400 nodes, and I think Freifunk has at least 600 nodes in Berlin at this point, or maybe 800, maybe you can correct me on the exact number.
I don't have the exact number, but it's much more now.
Absolutely, and I think the beauty of that design is that, and what people really don't understand, is that mesh networking allows a community to build a network that you would not have to pay a telecommunications company or a cable company if you just wanted to communicate. So it allows free communication. That means that anyone who had, for example, a cell phone or a router with a mesh networking card in it would be able to communicate with any other person in the network via email, via Skype, or any voice chat or instant messaging, without actually having to first pay a telecommunications company, because the network itself allows communication. Now, so that means if you have an 800 node network, that means 800 people or households could communicate with each other without actually having to go through a more centralized communication infrastructure. So that really means local control. Now, if one person in that network were to be able to connect to the internet, they would be able to share that connection with up to probably 100 other people. And what that means is that, you know, the sharing would dramatically reduce the cost of connecting to the internet. So instead of having 800 people paying $40 or $50 a month for a DSL or cable connection, you could actually have, you know, just 5 or 10 people paying for that connection and sharing it with the others. Now, of course, there are bandwidth restrictions and, you know, difficulties with the speed of the network, but it's a very different model than the corporate model that we currently have implemented in most of the cities and locations around the world.
So you just described two different models. On the one side, the failed ways of creating business models around municipal wireless, and on the other side, the community-based wireless networks. Is there a third way, what, for example, municipals can do?
Absolutely, and I think we're at that turning point right now because, as we know from, you know, from academic research and from history, is that often failure is what allows us to innovate better solutions. So I think we're at the point where many people do understand that community wireless has been relatively small initiatives operating kind of under the radar, and municipal wireless has been very large initiatives that are getting a lot of publicity about their efforts. Now, clearly, there should be a middle ground for public-private partnerships or for the city, the government, to actually leverage their own resources in the city. So, for example, the government's role to bring together maybe people from schools and churches and other community centers and bring them together in a common vision that they want to get, for example, people connected to the internet in order to encourage, you know, education and economic development. And one thing government can do is, instead of having to only spend money on equipment, which is not a very, it's not a model for really learning and growth in the community, what they can do is actually just help bring people together and maybe investigate some of these more community-based models, which are smaller scale and bottom up. But if you can convince enough people just to host, say, a wireless router that can network with all the other nearby infrastructure, you could actually build from a much cheaper infrastructure that would reach a lot of the same people. So one of the mistakes in municipal wireless over the last couple of years is that when we talk about the vision for a wireless city, for example, we constantly use language about anytime, anywhere access to the internet and ubiquity of access. And while on the one hand that does sound like a very attractive vision, but on the other hand, it's not realistic at this point. All the private sector companies know that it's actually much more expensive to build a network that would be reachable anytime, anywhere, or ubiquitous. And actually, it's also not really the model that we want, because what we really want is a network that's reachable for people when they need it in the places that they need it. And, you know, there are there are a lot of different ways to think about that. But instead of thinking about 100% coverage of every single public space, I think a better idea would be to just actually study human behavior, try to understand where do people hang out, where do they spend most of their time, where might they like to spend time, you know. And because the internet is something that we use, is really involved in almost all of our daily activities at this point, whether it be for work or for leisure time, you know, it's better to understand how people spend their time and where people spend their time and what places might it make sense to build that network. And that would be a far less expensive way, and it would be a more logical way to build the network. So we should move away from just building top-down infrastructure for the sake of technology and move towards building local bottom-up networks that really serve social needs.
Are there any official experiences within the United States?
Of what, for
or
example?
Or examples how you described other cities who tried mm-hmm. out bringing people together, having a bottom-up dialogue process?
I think, obviously government is not, you know, they certainly do, I think, understand that this is something that's necessary. And even in New York, there have been a series of 5 public hearings called the Broadband Advisory Task Force that were held in each borough of New York. And intended to get the ideas of local citizens in terms of how to improve broadband access in New York. So it's not that those things aren't happening at all, but unfortunately what happens is when a technology project is begins, often the loudest voices are those of the, for example, telecom and cable companies or the equipment providers, and they come in with one kind of corporate model about how to build a network, and often the community voices or those who might have expertise about building a different kind of network are just really not heard at all. So, for example, last year, a number of people who had attended the Wireless Summit, which was held in Columbia, Maryland, formed something called the Open Source Wireless Coalition. And that group, over the course of about 1 week, wrote a 20-page request for information document to the city of Boston, to Open Air Boston, in order to explain how an open source community-based model might work in Boston. But unfortunately, there's a lot of fear about trying new models that are not as, maybe don't have as much guarantee of working as old models. So there's some amount of risk involved. And at the time, we had not yet figured out how to link all the different open source softwares. So there was still time needed for really development of that actual, you know, wireless router infrastructure. But now we're at a point where a year later, there's been more development, and we're very a lot closer to something that would be easier to deploy. But it seems like there are not that many technical experts that actually can understand the full process. So we really do need those people, because in community wireless, we're really fortunate to have technical experts with very clear political beliefs and goals about what they're trying to do and why they're trying to do it. And there aren't enough of them necessarily to go around, but we also need people who really understand community-based work and nonprofits, and we need social science researchers and all of them working together. So I think that there are many, many small projects around the country and around the world that demonstrate alternative models. It's just that those models are not, there's little knowledge about them, and there definitely hasn't been enough research and really kind of to develop best practices or case studies or even to publicize those projects, because they're all very small scale.
You just mentioned the old gatekeepers, the telecommunication industry. What's their position around municipal wireless LAN?
Well, what we saw in 2004 in Philadelphia, when Philadelphia announced that they wanted to build a municipal wireless network, immediately the telecommunications and cable companies saw that as a threat to their business model. And so what happened in the United States is that they passed laws in, I believe, about 13 states that actually prohibited municipalities from getting into the business of building municipal wireless networks unless they first got permission from the telecom or cable company in their area. And this type of law doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, because, you know, why would the government pass laws that restrict their own rights about building infrastructure for their citizens? But what happened in the U.S. press, at least, it was very, very difficult to argue that Wi-Fi could be seen as something like a public good, or that internet access or broadband connectivity should be a public good. So that argument got really, the voices with the public good argument really were drowned out by the voice of the telecom and cable companies that said that municipal wireless competed unfairly with their business model. So I think 4 years later, we're now at a point where, because of the failure of a purely corporate model in terms of finding sustainable business revenue, we're at a point where we might be able to now rethink the question again and maybe make a better argument that Wi-Fi and internet connectivity in general should be considered as a public good. So lately, there have been discussions here in the United States. We have something called the Universal Service Fund, and that is money that's taken away from everyone's phone bill every month in order to pay for landline connectivity to very rural areas. Now we're trying to make arguments that, Universal Services funds should be used to connect people with broadband as well. So broadband is really more of a necessity and a right for citizens, because in order to be involved in the economy and really any kind of pursuit, you need to have high-speed access to the internet. And the United States ranks very poorly on broadband issues, and so we really need to do a lot more in order to improve broadband connectivity.
From your scientific perspective, what can governments do to support free networks, for example?
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about free networks, we usually talk about free access to the end user. And so governments, particularly in New York, what NYC Wireless has seen that has worked is partnering with business improvement districts. So these are neighborhood associations that businesses pay a membership fee. So if, for example, they see it as attractive to have Wi-Fi available in that neighborhood, businesses, you know, through these business improvement districts can support that. So government's role can be more to bring together the business improvement districts and the citizens and the parks organizations, for example, the Friends of the Park organization, to put together small projects that would actually cover certain areas of the city, but it would be a smaller scale. So that's one thing that government can do, is try to encourage the existing stakeholders who have an interest in having broadband availability to come together and really support that, and also to think of a more holistic model. Because another problem is that in the first 4 years, there's been a lot of thinking about access, but not a lot of thinking about how users are going to adopt broadband. So there are a lot of other factors that are involved, including the availability of laptops and the availability of training and education, so that people know how to use the technology to use the network. So really, government can help by thinking about a more holistic model and bringing together people at all stages of that model. So if we need education and training, then that should be a part of the project. If we need people to write content that's local and that really addresses certain communities, then that might be another aspect. But the first 4 years has been mainly about access, and so we haven't gotten far enough in the discussions. There are a number of groups that are trying to work on all of these aspects, including an organization called One Economy, and they're really knowledgeable about the idea that you really need content that's useful for the citizens that you want to serve. And so they work in mostly low-income housing, and they have a content portal called the Beehive, which is content that's specifically for the residents of those buildings. And they work in, I think, thousands of buildings around the U.S.
Another question is about airwaves, free access to special airwaves. Is there any debate within the United States?
Absolutely. And here in the United States, our model of Federal Communication Commission regulation is adopted around the world, actually. And so what happens here in the States has a lot of influence in what might happen in other countries, because many countries like to follow U.S. policy especially for spectrum issues. And so here in the U.S., we have, unlicensed spectrum, which is the spectrum that Wi-Fi technology uses, and we have licensed spectrum. And right now, the biggest debate is really trying to get back the analog spectrum that the broadcasters were using for TV broadcasting. And, now that they're starting to do digital broadcasting, there's a lot of white space spectrum, that the spectrum that's in between the channels, basically, that they are supposed to be giving back in the next year. And so the FCC is currently trying to decide who to give it, where to allocate that spectrum. And so one thing that community groups have found is that there is really a need for more unlicensed spectrum, because with better spectrum, then we could reach farther, we could have more robust networks. And so one of the most important arguments to make would be to illustrate to the FCC the incredible amount of innovation that's come out of the unlicensed band of spectrum, and to convince them that more spectrum is needed in that band. And also to convince him that even in the license band, that maybe there are more designations that could be made for community groups in the way that the FCC gave spectrum to the pirate radio groups, and those became, you know, more established through designating certain spectrum for community use. And that could be done for community wireless networks as well.
And how realistic is it?
Well, I think it seems to be very... I think it's realistic that community groups continue to argue for the need for spectrum and actually also make partnerships with private companies and other nonprofits and more established groups for to take over parts of the spectrum. But at this point, there are many people within the FCC that understand this issue completely, but the problem is that Congress is addicted to getting those licensing fees every year. You know, every time some spectrum opens up, that's a new opportunity for them to make money. And unfortunately, our country at the moment is just in such incredible deficit that it seems really attractive for them to continue to use spectrum to get, you know, money for the budget rather than to think about the most innovative things that could be done with the spectrum, as have happened in the unlicensed band.
Okay. So one demand is open spectrum, and the benefits are more innovation, for example.
Right. For example. And also just the ability for, more voices to be heard. So that's the idea, is that a community-owned network is using that spectrum and it's using it for local content and local infrastructure, and that, you know, the better the spectrum that they can use, then the more robust networks that you could have.
Okay, how long will it take until community wireless networks are all over the world?
Well, actually, community wireless networks are already all over the world, and it's incredible, even the number of networks. For example, Athens, Greece has apparently thousands of people participating in their community wireless network, and there are certainly models all over in Africa and in South America, and even in 2006, there was a community wireless summit called the World Summit on Free Information Infrastructure, which happened in Dharamsala, India. So these kinds of models are already all over the world, but I think what it will take in order to scale this model up are probably a technical solution that's easy to just plug and play. So something, there are many companies that are already experimenting with this model. For example, Meraki is a company that makes wireless routers that are very easy to just kind of plug in, and they have a great interface, and they allow community sort of meshes to form. And this is great, but the only problem is that it's not a completely open source solution. I think that some of their software layers are open source, but it's not a fully open source solution. And what we don't want to do is have we want to have a very robust and resilient network, which means that we don't want to only have private companies' software and hardware controlling the networks. We want something that people can almost build on their own, or at least learn how to build using cheap parts that are, you know, with open source software installed, and a community of developers that are currently updating it. And so we want something more similar to, you know, what Linux has done in the open software movement, but we want that for wireless networking equipment. And so we're I think very close to that, but what we would need really is to further develop both the hardware and the software, and also the interface, and make an interface that's really easy for anyone to just plug in and be part of a community wireless network. And also to make the arguments to local organizations like arts organizations or education groups why they should become a host of a network. And part of that would be that, you know, they could provide local content that would be available only maybe in a very kind of micro local area, but only to those people who are, you know, within that community network. So there are lots of great reasons. And I think that, you know, it's certainly probably still several more years of work in terms of the technical development, but also in terms of the social movement that's emerging. I heard Harold Feld, who's a lawyer who works with the Media Access Project, speaking yesterday, and he said that we need to changed from being more of a mob to being more of a movement. And so what we've had in the last 8 years of Community Wireless Network is lots of people doing lots of interesting things, but kind of doing them on their own and succeeding and failing and coming together a couple of times a year to tell each other about that and exchanging information on listservs and writing open source software. But what we haven't had is a very coordinated movement. And so this is, I think, still a barrier, is to really increase the coordination and educate a lot more people about, you know, really what the key issues are. And we haven't necessarily succeeded in that yet either.
Do you have ideas how to do it?
I do have ideas how to do it. I think what's good is that recently, you know, more and more people have figured out ways of kind of making a living, you know, spending their full-time activities really focused on this issue. So some of the key people in Community Wireless here in the States and also abroad have really found ways to have their livelihood really intersect with their social and political goals. So the more people we can tap into that are really kind of, you know, able to make a living and able to commit their efforts to Community Wireless, the better. It's really difficult, you know, especially here in New York, but anywhere in the world, when if people are focusing full time on just trying to pay their rent, they just don't have as much time to focus on spreading the word of Community Wireless. But a lot of people just even spending a small amount of time with a clear communication strategy could probably make a big difference. So I think part of it is just getting the message right. And it's only been in the last probably year that we've even really been able to articulate what is the clear message. Because earlier on, we focus a lot on just getting the networks to work. And now that we've overcome some of the technical aspects, you know, which the technical part is actually not the most complicated. The more complicated part is really the political organizing and getting the message out there. And now that we have seen this failure in the States of the large-scale municipal network model to work, there should be a space open for new ideas, new communications, new models, and that's a void that Community Wireless could really fill if we can get just kind of get the main message across.
And for the last question, what's now the conclusion? Can you conclude all the ideas or the moral and social impacts and arguments mm-hmm. altogether?
Yeah, it's really difficult because there are so many different issues that are involved. I mean, Community Wireless, it brings in almost every policy issue to do with communications and telecommunications law. It brings in privacy. It brings in freedom of expression. It brings in the digital divide or digital inclusion issues. It brings in network neutrality. It brings in intellectual property rights and copyright and innovation issues. So it's really just one kind of microcosm for so many different issues. So it's very difficult to conclude, but what I can say is that Community Wireless is just one of a number of progressive socio-technical movements that really fit alongside so many other movements. So you're wearing the Creative Commons t-shirt, and that's another really like-minded social movement. Really, I think, you know, and what many people have been saying for quite a long time now, for example, I remember Lauren Schlesig saying in about the year 2000 that the technical movements need to become more like the environmental movement. So the environmental movement took about, you could say, 30 years to really, really be clearly understood as a social movement and really start to have a major impact. So we live in a time where, you know, sustainability and sustainable design are not only buzzwords, but there are a lot of people who are very interested in trying to figure out how to make that work. And because we're in an oil crisis, and there are so many practical reasons why we would want to make that work. Communication rights as a social movement, or looking at communication as a human right, and that broader umbrella, I think is still relatively in the first, maybe even just the first decade, even though of course you have hundreds of years of history where you can point to And community wireless is just one very small part of that larger social movement.
Okay, that was nice last words. And thank you very much for the interesting interview. And good luck with your work here.
Okay, thanks, Marcus.